This is Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski.
We're diving back into one of the hottest cases that there is, the Karen Reed case. Judge Beverly Cannone, depending on who you ask, she's either keeping the trial fair and focused, or she's the fourth prosecutor hiding in plain sight. Supporters of Karen Reed say that she's biased, censoring the defense, and protecting the so-called Canton cover-up. Critics claim that she's overstepping, silencing protests, and limiting what the jury gets to hear. On the flip side, others argue that she's just following the rule of law. She's cool-headed in a courtroom that's turned into a reality show with a true crime Twitter subplot. Joining us to discuss, someone who knows both sides of the courtroom, former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Fattis. Eric, let's start here. When a judge begins limiting suspects, excluding expert witnesses, and blocking an attorney from joining the defense team, it sounds pretty bad on the surface, but when you dig into the reasoning behind these choices, to me it makes a little bit more sense from a legal standpoint. What are your thoughts?
You know, the common understanding is a person gets their day in court, right? And so some people think that that means they get to go in there and say whatever they want and call whatever witnesses they want and do whatever they want. But that's not the reality inside that courtroom. Inside that courtroom, there are rules. And oftentimes, witnesses are limited. Defenses are limited. Attorneys can be limited. That one's a little less common. But by and large, those types of rulings are something that are rather common.
And a lot of these rulings that we're talking about here, in this case, there's been several that she's been looking at. One of them was the attorney that they wanted to bring in. The name eludes me at this moment in time. There was another one they were trying to bring in other than just the juror. And then you also have the issue of potential witnesses, the potential third-party culprit that they were trying to go after, Colin Elbert being one of them, the teen that they say was part of this conspiracy, and it does play a big role in their defense, at least it certainly did in the last one. What's your thoughts on that, on limiting who can and can't come in, and why the judge would make that decision, and what is the bar for allowing some of these theories to play in and allowing people to become witnesses?
Tony, what we're talking about is an alternative suspect theory. And so, you know, defense oftentimes in a case like this, they want to point the finger at one or multiple people to kind of give the impression of reasonable doubt in terms of who did this. Here, in order to present such a defense, usually you need what's called a non-speculative connection between the third party and the allegations it charged. And so, you know, you can't just say, could have been this guy or possibly him. You have to sort of be able to draw a line, a direct connection between Colin Elbert and and what happened. And the judge is saying, hey, there's not enough there to do that. Although I do understand the judge is allowing defense to argue alternative suspects for two other individuals. I think Brian Higgins and perhaps the other name escapes her.
Yeah. Why? I guess if you're going to pull, the kid out, which makes sense because I think it's a ridiculous theory. If you just look at the facts and you look at evidence, I mean, they're trying to hang their hat on with the Colin Elbert is the Knuckles photo, where there's a photo of him actually right after the death of John O'Keefe and his knuckles are fine. And then a couple weeks later, there's one where they're scraped up, but they certainly do not look like they were in a fight unless John O'Keefe was made out of concrete. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So I get that. And the fact that he's a kid, and why on earth would he have any reason to kill an officer or be part of a conspiracy? But why the other two? Why are they allowing that in when, I mean, I don't know, on the surface, it feels like it's just as an insane argument.
My hunch is that the other two are at least more intimately involved in the series of events that lead up to John O'Keefe's death. For example, Brian Higgins was at the bar. Mm-hmm. He was talking with Karen Reed. He was talking with John O'Keefe. defense is going to try to spin that into some sort of nefarious involvement once they got back to the Albert's house. Mm-hmm. Whereas Colin Albert, the kid, he wasn't present for any of these things that led up to and gave rise to John O'Keefe's death. And so I think perhaps they're just saying that, hey, these other two have enough direct involvement, even though I did see the judge have mentioned that there is still sort of scant evidence of alternative suspect for Brian Higgins and the other person, but enough to meet the bar, whereas for the kid Albert, not enough.
They did the internal investigation, or not internally, an external investigation into their into the department of how they handled the case. Came out, yeah, sloppy police work, without a doubt, and a lot of missteps there. But no conspiracy. No. They didn't find anything that shows that they were trying to frame Karen Reed. That's what it came out to be. The defense wanted to have an FBI expert come in and give some context to it and ask him what he thought of how the case went and how the investigation went. Judge Cannone said, basically, look, the jury can make their own decision based on all the witnesses you're going to call. They can make their conclusion. Was that a fair move to say that you can't have the expert or the former FBI agent come in and give some insight and basically kind of hold their hand and walk them through that? We see it in other cases sometimes where an expert comes in to help define evidence and what's going on. And this would be kind of defining what was in those findings. What's your thoughts on that ruling?
You know, actually a pretty common ruling, especially in Colorado where I practice. In order to call an expert, they have to be talking about expert stuff, which means information that is outside the purview of a normal juror's understanding. You know, a normal juror can say whether a person engaged in self-defense, but they can't necessarily say like how digital forensics were investigated, something like that. And so what the judge is saying is like, hey, the jury can decide if this was shoddy police work or not. Any layperson is capable of doing that. It's not expert testimony, according to the judge. And that's a common ruling that we see. Now, for example, if this was a use of force case with police, then you're getting more likely to have an expert talk about police standards and whether they were met. But those issues are not germane to whether Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe with her car.
Let's talk about the other issue. We were kind of touching on it earlier. The Mark Bedrow, who's representing the blogger, and they wanted to bring him in. That's the other attorney that they wanted to bring in. Obviously, representing both people does present a bit of a conflict of interest because it could benefit or it could hurt either side, depending on what comes in. What's your thoughts on that? You had some attorney. I mean, obviously, the rest of her legal counsel thought it was a good idea. I mean, these are not dumb attorneys. They're very, very experienced, and they thought it was good. Karen Reed signed off on it. The blogger signed off on it. The judge said no. Was that a wise decision, a fair decision to prevent there being any sort of conflict of interest down the road?
You know, a defendant's choice of counsel is usually a pretty important choice that has to be recognized. Here, I think the judge was balancing three considerations. One is that there is a possible conflict of interest. The judge has to make sure that conflict doesn't occur because it could result in a reversal down the road. Additionally, this case has been dragging on for quite some time. We're at the second trial, and perhaps a new attorney might stall things. There have been delays requested by defense before, and perhaps the judge foresaw something like that and wanted to eliminate that. On top of that, you know, just the defense already has a lot of attorneys. And so one more, you know, might be seen as cumulative and unnecessary. And the judge, I think, is saying, hey, we got to get this thing tried. We got to get some finality. And I'm worried that those considerations might impair our ability to do that.
Seems like there's a lot of issues here regarding the gag order on this case. Every time I go to Twitter, there's Karen saying something. The gag order. Does that simply apply to the attorneys of Karen Reed, or is Karen free to speak to anyone that she wants?
Typically, it applies to the attorneys and the parties.
Yeah.
And Karen is a party. She's a defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we saw in the Trump legal matters that gag orders can come up against a person's right to free speech. And that analysis is pretty complicated and would happen at the appellate level down the road. So although the gag order would apply to Karen Reed, she may have been advised that she has a First Amendment right to speak anyway, and she might be kind of testing the waters and pushing the envelope there in hopes the judge doesn't shut her down.
I saw a clip this morning of her eating a bag of chips and talking to people. It was really weird. It's like, put the bag of chips down, Karen. The reporters have microphones by you and you're answering their questions. It's just like, and then her attorneys are on the steps like, get up here. It's like, I'm sorry. My attorneys are calling me because she happened to slip up and say that nobody's being paid. That's an interesting angle here because she's getting all sorts of money from people. The support Karen Reed, the defense fund, all of that. Again, you've got a fundraise, you got costs usually for something like this, but the amount that she's raised, that's a lot of pantsuits for what she's gotten. Is there any issue with that, where you're raising money for your defense, but your defense is doing this pro bono? What the hell's going on with all of that? And does that raise a potential issue down the road? I mean, is that fraud? If you're saying you're going to get this money and you're going to be using it on that, it's certainly, you know, there's only so many hotel rooms you're going to have to pay for. There's only so many realistic expenses that you could say, well, yes, I'm not paying them that, but I'm using it over here for these expenses. It doesn't quite add up to that if you kind of do the math.
There are multiple concerns. One is that from the prosecution standpoint, Karen Reed is kind of enriching herself,
yes,
by taking this generously donated money and not using it for the cause that she kind of said she would use it for. And that gives rise to a potential legal issue, like you said, of fraudulent conduct, or at the very least of some level of deception that the government might try to use against her. If her words come in to evidence at the behest of the defense, the prosecution can put on rebuttal evidence of her being deceptive because it goes to her credibility.
Would that be a whole other case? Would that not be this murder trial? Could there be a follow-up to this thing where it's some sort of fraud trial that could be brought against her?
Oh gosh, you know, it's not separate and apart from like charity fraud, that sort of thing happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, and so you know, folks can be separately charged in that instance. She could be separately charged in this instance.
Yeah, I find it very bizarre.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.